yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, 99%ers. This is your host, Jack Rasmus. All right, is there a topic this week? Well, that's a rhetorical question, because the obvious topic is the continuing stock market plummet, maybe even plunge. Well, we had two record declines in the Dow this week, and of course the S&P 500 and the other NASDAQ followed suit, and that was on Monday, which followed an initial decline on Friday of about 2.5%. Remember, we talked briefly about that last week, and we predicted that this thing was just beginning. And of course, on Monday, we had an 1,175-point collapse at one point, over 1,500-point decline in the Dow. And as I wrote quickly on Monday in a piece on my blog, jackrasmus.com, that talked about that collapse worldwide, because over the weekend it spread, of course, to Europe and Asia, even China, the stock correction, stock market corrections. And read my piece on jackrasmus.com about the 1,175-point decline. And at the time, I predicted that there would be a recovery of some of that lost, but it would be a dead cat bounce. That's a phrase used in markets where you get a collapse and then that follows by a recovery, a fool's recovery, and then it declines again. In other words, the savvy buyers go in and purchase at real low prices that are now in effect because of the collapse, but they plan to sell it just as quickly. You get a increased demand for the stocks and the price goes up a little bit, and then they dump it again and you get another collapse, a second leg down. In other words, the metaphor of a dead cat, right? The dead cat flops. Whoop, then he jumps up, runs around a little bit, and then he flops and rolls over. Well, I predicted there would be a dead cat bounce. And, of course, we had that yesterday, didn't we? Another 1,000-plus collapse in the Dow. And the others, of course, follow suit, other stocks in the U.S. and globally, because all these stock markets now are tightly integrated. Technology has caused this integration. And the flip side of this tight integration, this instantaneous integration, of course, is contagion. And it's the same investors who are buying and selling in U.S. stocks, causing bubbles that they did, are the same investors who quickly move their money around into other markets in Asia overnight. Hedge funds, particularly hedge funds, equity firms, all these speculators, this is what I've been calling the new shadow banks, and the actual capitalist investors are the new finance capital elite. And they've got this network of global financial asset markets tightly linked now, and they move the money around, not just stock markets, but derivatives, trading, which we don't see because it's opaque. Property trading, real estate, and trading in, you know, currencies and speculating in currencies, and all kinds of casinos out there for them. And they move their money around rapidly overnight, and they cause bubbles in one, and they move it to another. This is what I was talking about in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. You know, this is also the era of financial securities engineering, the 21st century. If they've got all these markets all linked, and we have this new finance capital elite sector of about 200,000 multimillionaires, income millionaires, by the way, not wealth, but with an income flow of tens of millions of dollars a year. There's about 200,000 of them globally. And these are the big culprits. Not to say there aren't other traditional culprits, but they're the ones really moving the money around, and their institutions are these unregulated shadow banks of various kinds. And they create these financial securities, and they buy and sell in them. It's a global casino for them, and there's a lot of ways and places to play in the casino. A lot of it is online, and they do so. And of course, they are destabilizing the hell out of the global capitalist economy in the 21st century. Well, even began in the late 20th. That's a major characteristic of global capitalism today. The new global finance capital elite, flush with liquidity and funds, massive, unmatched ever. They've got more investable liquid assets than the commercial banks of the world have now. Of course, they are integrated as well with the commercial banks. But they are a distinct segment now, and they are responsible for these bubbles. Well, we're going to talk about a little bit how they precipitated this downturn here in the past week, which is going to continue. If you look at stock prices today, boy, are they volatile. Going up 200 or 300 positive points, going down 300 or 400 positive points, bouncing around. Something has fundamentally changed with the second leg down here of yesterday. Following the one on Monday, all the talking finance business heads, trot out on their media shows and in the press, they write their articles and so forth, saying, "Oh, this is normal. This is normal. This is just a correction, and it's a good opportunity to buy on the dip." Oh, but now you got a second dip. Are they going to still sing that song? Buy again on the dip? Well, you can keep buying on the dip and keep going down. And I think a lot of your retail investors, meaning not these professional speculators, shadow bank speculators, are now really burned. They rushed into the market at its peak here, which had an especial acceleration after November, December. Right. The stocks, U.S. stocks went up, what, 7, 8% in 1 month here in January? Well, that's considered a good year. In just 1 month, the prices escalated a year's worth. Well, a lot of that was Johnny come latelys jumping in, thinking they're going to get in on an ever-rising stock market and financial markets in general. And they throw their money in, and they're the big losers. They're the ones that are really just giving their money to the professional speculators who are going to scoop it up in subsequent months and weeks. Well, dummies deserve what they get. In any event, what we got now is something fundamentally has changed, I would submit here, in the psychology of investors. They are really nervous, and they will take their money and move their losses and move to the sidelines now. And who knows what comes next? Well, a lot of volatility. The biggest decline here in 1 week since October 2008. $5 trillion in paper value, of course, has been lost. 5 trillion. A real formal correction, as they say, at least 10% drop in the market prices in the US, 10% about in Germany and Europe, and more than that in China. Over 12% decline in China. Well, is this another 2008 crash that's just beginning? Or is it more like the 1999 2000 dot-com tech bust? In other words, the Nasdaq, the tech markets crashed in 99, 2000, actually March of 2000. Is this more like 2000 or more like 2008? Well, in 2000, the dot-com crash, a little history background here, was driven by tech stock speculation. People were buying tech stocks and driving up the price of tech stocks for companies that didn't even have a product that they were selling. Incredibly, that's how bad the herd fever mentality got. There were stupid products and stupid companies coming out. Like I remember at the time, a company whose stock was escalating. Its product was called a pet rock. Yeah, they'd sell a rock in a box, believe it or not. And people were buying the stock of that company. Companies that were just penny stock companies with very little revenue, where stock price is selling at $100, $150 a share. It got crazy. All right. Well, that tech stock market crashed in March of 2000. And it then spilled over to the other non-tech industries, manufacturing, and then it eventually spilled over to the rest of the economy, the real economy I'm talking about. When the tech stocks crashed, the tech industries laid off massively and pulled in their horns because they couldn't get financing because their stock prices were collapsing. Okay. And then, of course, it spilled over thereafter to other sectors of the stock market, non-tech, and then to the service side of the economy. And we entered a recession in early 2001 as a result. That recession, of course, was mild in 2001, recession in the real economy, because 9/11 and the government. The Bush administration just came into office, really boosted defense spending and government spending in the fall, third quarter of 2001. And that offset and muted the decline in the fourth quarter. So we had a very mild 2001 recession because of massive government spending injections that occurred. All right. Do we have that now? No, no massive government spending. In fact, just the opposite. And in fact, we've been operating on a kind of a American-style austerity fiscal spending since 2010. Oh yes, there's defense spending that's ballooning, but that doesn't create much jobs, especially since a lot of the defense spending is now farmed out to U.S. allies offshore. So the job effect, income effect, consumption effect is not all that great anymore for defense spending. So, to summarize, 2000 stock, it was a stock market crash, and it did spill over into the real economy, but was offset by government fiscal spending acceleration. Well, this is a stock market-led financial contraction. So in that sense, it's like 2000. Ah, but it's also like 2008. Well, what was the nature of the 2008 crash? That was derivatives-driven, linked to property speculation, housing, subprime mortgages, right? And subprime mortgages created this edifice of what we call derivatives, mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, both commercial and residential, which were repackaged into CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and on top of that, synthetic CDOs, on top of that, credit default swaps. So we had this mountain of derivatives that were built upon the housing boom and other areas as well. The shadow bankers had really come into their own, and they're the ones who drove this derivatives trading and offering. And also, insurance companies like AIG writing all those credit default swaps. So the shadow banks got overexposed to property speculation. And the first, of course, to go under was Bear Stearns in March of 2008. And that set in motion a chain reaction that went to other markets like government GSE securities linked to housing, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And that led to Washington Mutual and Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and all the others. And then AIG, and then it started dragging down the commercial banks that had loaned a lot of money to these shadow banks to engage in property speculation and did so themselves because there was deregulation. Citibank, Bank of America, etc. Lehman Brothers got in deep doo-doo largely because it had bought late in the cycle these properties, housing and residential and commercial properties that had already peaked. And then when the crash came, it dragged down Lehman Brothers. So did Bank of America, bought Countrywide and others that were at their peak. And Merrill Lynch did the same. And then Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch. Oh, it was a mess. But they were all chasing the huge profits that had occurred because of derivatives trading that fueled the property price speculation, and the property price speculation, housing prices fueled the derivatives. So it was kind of a derivatives driven crisis, and spilled over to the credit system and dragged down, froze up the entire credit system because commercial banks were also linked into this whole problem now. But it was derivatives trading, by AIG and the shadow banks, the investment banks, and even linked to General Motors and General Electric with their financial finance companies locked into the same problem. And the derivatives were all linked between these investment banks and real banks. And of course, that caused a contagion effect. And the commercial banks were heavily indebted, not indebted, but connected to lending to hedge funds and investment banks. So they were linked into it. So 2008 crash was derivatives based and really led to the credit system freezing up totally. And we saw these channels of contagion, unlike the 2001 stock market crash. Well, derivatives had not been really fully developed at the time. They were there in 2000, but they really came into their own by 2007, 2008. Well, the current crash has characteristics of both 2000, stock market oriented, and 2008, derivatives. Well, what derivatives? What are we talking about when we say derivatives here? Well, derivatives are products, financial products, that are created from other products, which could be other derivatives even, or other real products like mortgages in 2008. They're repackaged and sold by the shadow banks and other banks. And marked up and sold. And then you take those products that have been marked up and sold and you bundle them with even more derivatives, derived from derivatives. And you mark that up and sell that, CDOs and then CDSs. You write contracts for, insurance contracts in case it will collapse. And then, like AIG, they wrote more insurance contracts than they could cover. So that's what derivatives are. Well, the problem today is not property prices, and it's not derivatives a la 2008-9, but it is derivatives once again. Well, what are the derivatives? And these derivatives are tied into stock prices. So that's what I mean when I say it has characteristics of both 2000 and 2008. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Stock markets today are more integrated than they've ever been because of technology. And the new derivatives are what? As I've been warning for some time in my articles, it's the new trend towards exchange traded funds, exchange traded notes, exchange traded products of various kinds. This is the new financial engineering, and it's been going on for some time now, and it has a lot to do with the run-up of this recent stock bubble. Well, what do we mean? Well, you've got shifts, changes in the stock market towards what we call passive index trading. That's what ETFs are. You can, instead of buying an individual stock, these financial engineers and the shadow banks and banks as well, what they do is bundle up stocks, sound familiar, bundling, right? In a product called an ETF, exchange traded fund. Or they bundle up bonds, exchange traded bond fund. Or they bundle up currencies and reissue, mark it up, and sell it. Well, instead of trying to figure out where the market is going, a lot of investors, particularly what we call small retail investors, simply buy the ETF or ETB or ETP. It's a derivative made up of other stocks. And they just ride that collective stock market rise. Now, you tie in that with what's called quantitative trading, algorithmic trading, quant hedge funds, and so forth. And you get what's called momentum investing. Momentum, in other words, stock prices go up, therefore you get more buying and more demand for the stock, and the stock price goes up, and then you get more buying, automated buying, right? And or not automated, and that increases the demand, and the stock price keeps going up. It's momentum. As long as prices keep rising, the demand will continue driving up prices. Well, that's the definition of speculation, you see. Price-driven investment, short-term price-driven investment, at which point when you make a significant capital gain, you will flip it and experience your capital gain. Well, as long as the prices keep going up and it looks like the market is not volatile, which it hasn't been until recently, in other words, it's safe, it appears to be safe, and there's an index called the VIX, the Chicago Board of Trade has created this product here a decade or so ago called the VIX, which measured stock market volatility. And you can see it turning, turn on one of your business TV shows, and they always have the VIX there, right? How volatile is the stock market? Well, the VIX, was totally unvolatile the past year. It just sat there below 10 in single digits sometimes. Wasn't moving. Well, it must be safe. The prices are rising, and more ETFs are being issued, and more investors are buying, putting money into ETFs, and that's driving up the price of the stock, which brings more money into ETFs. It does the same. And not everything looks volatile, stable, safe. So let's just keep riding this horse, this momentum trading, quant algorithm buying, selling horse. Well, that's new, you see, where the new derivatives is the ETFs riding on this passive index investing trend and momentum buying and quants and algorithms, right? Automatic sales and so forth. Automatic buying. And that gives it the characteristic, you see, the current crisis gives it the same characteristic as 2008. Maybe the actual products are different. It's not subprime mortgages and CDOs, MBSs, etc. It's ETFs of various kinds, exchange traded, and it's automated selling, automated selling. Based on algorithms that they think they understand, and momentum trading. Well, momentum up can become momentum down, you see. And when the momentum turns and the prices start falling, the automated trading says, oh, you got to liquidate this ETF. and people can't even sell it because no one wants to buy it, and they know it's about to be liquidated, so the prices collapse even further. Now, these ETFs are tied to the stock market, if it's a stock ETF, right? And if that's so, then it's going to drag down the stock market. Once the panic selling begins, the quant algorithmic selling machine kicks in, right? And ETFs get liquidated, then guess what? The stocks that were involved with them get dragged down in price too. And then the psychology spills over from passive index trading to trading in general. All right, so that's that particular topic about how it's similar and different to both 2000 and 2008. And of course, because it's the global economy and stock markets are even more integrated instantaneously, it quickly spreads everywhere, right? When you're looking at and trying to understand what's going on both with the financial economy and the real economy, you have to think about different qualitative kinds of causation. In my 2010 book, I introduced this idea. 2010 book was Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. And theoretically, that was followed up in 2016 with my Systemic Fragility book, which looked at financial, global finance capital elites and so forth, and critiqued mainstream economic theory. And then, of course, my latest book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, and I'll explain how they are involved with this qualitative explanations of causality. Okay, so what are these qualitative explanations? Well, I think you need to distinguish between causes that are precipitating, in other words, that set off the stock market crash or the real economy correction, contraction, right? From enabling causes. And enabling causes from fundamental causes. So there's three kinds of causation that are qualitatively different: precipitating, enabling, and fundamental. Now, mainstream economists do not make that distinction. Mainstream economists say it was either a cause or effect. Actually, most of them sing the tune that just because there's a correlation, it must be a causation. You know, most of mainstream economists peddling is asserting that there's causation when there's really only correlation. No. So I distinguish between those three types. Well, what were the precipitating causes of this past week's contraction, which is now a formal contraction, formal correction of 10%, but I think it's going further. Ups and downs, you know. First of all, last Friday, it begins last Friday on the 2nd of February. And what happened last Friday? Well, we got a jobs report. And the jobs report indicated, oh, we still got robust job hiring going on. Oh, the economy must be very solid and overheated, maybe even. And that robust jobs report, what solidified the view that, oh, inflation is coming. Now I'm talking about real goods and services inflation, goods and services, not financial asset inflation. You see, mainstream economists only focus on goods inflation, not on financial asset inflation, because that's what how they were trained. And they really don't understand financial markets or financial cycles and how they interact with non-financial cycles. Okay, so they keep talking about the CPI or the PCE indexes for goods and services. And this jobs report sort of solidified the idea, well, inflation's coming. Well, you know, you tie that into what the Federal Reserve has been doing and now says it's going to do four more times, and that's raised interest rates. Well, they must be raising interest rates because they see inflation coming. And inflation is coming because the economy is doing so well and jobs are continuing. That's the logic. Well, it's logic, but it's not reality. First of all, a lot of the jobs being created, as I've been saying, are not really full-time permanent jobs that pay well. These are jobs that are really what we call contingent jobs, independent contract jobs, on-call jobs, temp jobs, gig jobs, so forth. They don't pay that well. And that's why wages are not really rising. They keep looking for all these examples of, oh, wages are rising, and they use averages that factor in wages and salaries and bonuses and so forth for the wealthiest 10% of wage and salary earners, and even income of managers and CEOs and so forth. And okay, so it looks like wages are rising a little bit even then. But they aren't really rising. Next week, we'll talk in more detail why wages aren't really rising. So, if wages are rising, they think that, well, prices must have to rise even more. Prices are rising a little bit, and wage increases are coming because job increases are coming, therefore prices are coming. Well, that's all based on the false assumption that wages drive prices. And there's not much evidence of that. But the mainstream economists keep singing that tune, wages drive prices, because that's what was developed in the 1950s and 60s with what they call the Phillips curve. But the Phillips curve is a fiction. It doesn't really exist, but they worked it into their models, and even the Federal Reserve believes it. So, Phillips curve ideology is at work. It's a part of the conventional wisdom here. But there's no wage increases, and even if there were, it's not going to be driving prices, core inflation, up at all. Now, last Friday, a new Fed chair also took office, Jerome Powell, right? No one knows what he's going to do. Well, Jerome is right in the tradition of Janet Yellen, who's right in the tradition of Ben Bernanke and Greenspan, and they're going to do whatever they need to do to protect the banks and the financial system and free money. Free money. They're going to push this free money continuing into these banks. Well, you might say, well, wait a minute, they're raising interest rates. That's making free money a little less available, isn't it? To some extent. But they're only doing this because it's pretty clear that the politicians, friends of big business, all of them virtually in Washington, are subsidizing capital incomes with fiscal policy, tax cuts, and deregulation now. So the Fed, who's been doing the same thing, subsidizing for 7 years between 2009 and 16, with zero, near zero interest rates, in other words, free money, the Fed does not have to do that now that the shift has been to subsidize capital incomes with taxes, tax cuts, and deregulation, and government subsidies, and so forth. So the Fed is backing off and has been for the past year as this was coming. Is there going to be further subsidization? Well, the whole infrastructure spending may be another form of corporate subsidization. It's not going to be infrastructure spending as you know it, as we've known it. It's going to be another form of subsidizing commercial real estate. Anyway, we got this back off of the Fed a little bit. Now the Fed can raise rates a little bit. But the Fed, I predict, and will continue to predict, is not going to raise them four more times this year. Why is that? Well, because, as I've been saying, it can't. It's going to precipitate a credit crunch if it raises it much more. As I said in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, and subsequent articles on my blog, the Fed cannot raise its benchmark rate, which is 1.5% right now, much over 2%, maybe two more quarter point hikes. That will drive 10-year bond rates over 3%. And now you're in territory where you can precipitate a credit crunch. right? When the 10-year gets over 3%, and the federal funds rate gets over 2%. You know, and it's interesting to compare that hypothesis on my part with what happened in 2007-8. The Fed was able to raise rates, its rates, over 5% before the credit crash came. Well, now what I'm saying is it can't even raise its rates half that before it does the same thing. In other words, the global economy, U.S. economy, is financially more fragile than it's ever been before. And it's fragile because there's even more massive debt in the economy. Households debt, you know, is back where it was, just for four areas over four, maybe $5 trillion now. Student debt, auto debt, credit card debt, and of course, housing debt over 7, 8 trillion, right? Just housing debt. So the consumer is tapped out. The consumer is full of debt. And you can see it in the run-up in credit card and auto debt last year that kept the economy humming. You can see it in the excess of total household debt to disposable income, and the fact that households have been what dragging money out of their savings. The savings rate is only 2.4% now in the U.S. You know, it was over 10%. Now it's 2.4%. Well, that means consumers are consuming based upon drawing down their savings and taking on more debt. That cannot be sustained. And then, if you don't have real wage increases, which I say is still the case, where's the consumption going to come from? You see, that's the problem. And they know that. Well, they've been boosting up business investment and inventories in anticipation that the consumer spending would continue from 2017. But they may be rudely shocked when that doesn't happen later this year. Okay, so precipitating causes, back to that topic, job announcement, assumptions about wage and price increases, Powell taking office, and apparently will continue, the assumption is, the Fed price hikes, and a steady rise in bond yield price bond yields. That have been occurring over recent weeks. The core inflation, as it rises slightly, is not due to real economic growth. It's due to factors that don't reflect real growth, like rent and housing price increases, costs of health care escalating now with the collapse of Obamacare. Business expectations of, now we got a recovery, let's quick hike our prices, take advantage of it, which are temporary, can't be sustained. This is where the price increases, you know, and to some extent gas and energy prices. This is where the price increases have been coming from to the extent they have. So there's really not solid price increases, really not solid wage increases, and the job increases, job gains are not real income boosting job gains. And in comes Powell, and he's going to increase rates still further. Well, this was a signal. All these causes last week were a signal, and what happened was the shadow bankers, the quant hedge fund guys and others who had speculated with the ETFs, their algorithms indicated sell, and they sold. And that precipitated, dragged down the stock prices in general. This all occurred Friday, began to occur Friday. So the precipitating, technical stock precipitating factor was the quants, the hedge funds, the ETFs. All right, now what are the deeper enabling causes? In other words, what is it over a longer term, not just last week, that set up the stock markets for this major correction? Well, we clearly got a bubble in U.S. stocks beginning in late 2016 when Trump came into office through 2017, sometimes called the Trump trade. Well, why did we get this bubble? In anticipation of these massive tax cuts for corporations and businesses and investors, which would then be redistributed to the big shareholders because of the huge profit windfall from the tax cuts. And it was estimated that these tax cuts will boost profits 10 to 31% on average, depending what industry and company, 10 to 31%, an immediate profit boost without doing anything is what they get. It's a windfall, a huge windfall. And these corporations are going to do what they've been doing, and that is take that money and use it to buy back their stocks, to pay out more dividends, to buy up their competition in mergers and acquisitions, and maybe to send it offshore. This is what they've been doing under the Fed since 2009 with the massive injection of funds by the Federal Reserve Central Bank. This is what they've been doing with the money. And now we've got the fiscal side, the government playing the role of the Fed of subsidizing with massive tax cuts to investors and corporations, and they're going to do the same with it. You watch. So once the tax cut got actually implemented, you see, for a year it was anticipation of it, but once it got implemented, well, then we got an even faster acceleration of the stock market in December and January. It was a fact, not just a likelihood. Expectations of a profitability boost throughout 2019, 17 rather, and then the actuality of it in the last 2 months sent stock markets in the US up. And of course, the same phenomenon eventually began to emerge in Europe and then a little later in Japan. Now, what else enabling? So the tax cuts were a big enabling factor here over the past little longer term, medium term. Well, what were some of the other enabling forces? Well, huge corporate profits, huge profits for 7 years accumulated, and more than corporations and businesses could or wanted to invest, particularly in the US, in real investment, real goods and services. Again, they were buying back their stock, which drove up the bubble. Also dividends that gave more money to their rich investors who reinvested it in stock and drove up the bubble further. You know, all these things are linked. So the huge profits and the very low interest rates, which enabled corporations to borrow money and distribute it in buybacks and dividends. Instead of taking the huge profits that they had, the money was so low because of the Fed, so cheap, they would just borrow the money and distribute it, divvy it out. And that drove the stock markets up and other financial markets up even further, you see. And then you have this global stock market integration. So the boom spread in 2017, 18. Beyond the US, because these are the same professional investors. Now, that's not the only enabling. The profits and the corporate borrowing, and by the way, corporations in the US borrowed well over $6 trillion. $6 trillion. And that's just about the amount that they distributed since 2010. Maybe it's 7 trillion now. We don't have the figures for 2017. But $6 to $7 trillion in raising of debt, corporate debt, raising of the debt, and a lot of that got redistributed. Some got hoarded, some went offshore, right? And some of the redistribution was because of the profits. So that was an enabling cause. medium term. But there's another couple enabling causes. One is not only did corporations load themselves up on more corporate debt, but buyers of stock loaded up on debt by what's called margin buying. Margin buying a stock. A lot of them were what we call retail buyers. What's margin? Well, if the value of your stock keeps rising in prices, which it did, you can borrow more. You don't have to put up your own money. You can borrow more from the brokerage, and the brokerage will let you use that borrowed money to buy even more stock. So the more rises, the more you borrow, and the more stock you buy, which drives up the price, which, you know, you got a circular event going on here. Well, how much margin buying did we see in 16, 17? How much? Well, in 2011 to 14, margin buying, debt margin buying was only about $10 billion a year only. In other words, investors in stocks were borrowing $10 billion on their previous stock. But in 2016, this rose to $200 billion, and in 2017, $300 billion borrowing to buy more stock. Now, that $300 billion in 2017 compares to during the dot-com boom of 1999-2000, less than $100 billion. So this time around, margin buying is three times higher than it was in 2000 with that particular stock market boom and bust. So margin buying, by the way, also was really the culprit behind the 2015 China stock bubble and bust. Well, is behind playing a major role here as well in the U.S., and then we have changes, structural changes in the stock markets themselves. The shift towards what I call passive investing in recent years, indexing, momentum trading, quantitative algorithm trading, and so forth. These are trends that got even deeper embedded in the stock market. These structural changes, the margin buying, the excess profits and corporate buying, stock buybacks and dividends and so forth, and the tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, all of these together, you know, were major forces, enabling causes driving up the bubble in the last couple of years, and especially since Trump came into office. But there are even more fundamental causes of this. What are the fundamental causes? Well, I already alluded to them. The massive injection of liquidity, money, free money, into the economy by the central bank. One of the themes, major themes in my central banker's book, is that the Federal Reserve, as all central banks, undertakes certain functions. One of those functions is called lender of last resort and money supply management. Lender of last resort means they're going to bail out a bank or the banking system when it gets in trouble, which it typically periodically does. But I argue in my book that since 2010, this lender of last resort function has become a permanent subsidization of the banking system function. Why would the Federal Reserve and the central banks continue pumping free money into these banking systems, into these banks, when they were bailed out by 2010, at least in the U.S.? They didn't get bailed out in Europe till 2012-13. They've never been bailed out in Japan. Why would they continue for so long providing free money, enabling them to raise trillions of dollars in cheap bonds and boosting financial asset markets? The Fed is, and other central banks who follow it, because they all follow the Fed and the advanced economies, the Fed is the ultimate culprit of all of this going on, financial instability growing over the last three decades. The Fed pumped $5 to $6 trillion in free money into the economy under Bernanke and Yellen. Yes, under Yellen too. And globally, the banks, central banks, have pumped over $25 trillion into the economy. Well, you know, the Bank of International Settlements, which is kind of a Bank of Central Banks research arm in Geneva, has indicated that in terms of global debt, the debt has increased even more so today than it was in 2007-8, the global debt, right? Non-financial global debt is now in the U.S., 96% of GDP, in other words, $18 trillion, right? And 37% of companies in the U.S. are highly leveraged. In other words, they're overloaded with debt. Now, they're able to service, pay the principal and interest on that debt as long as their stock prices keep rising and their profits keep rising. But when they don't rise, well, then the debt stays there and still has to be serviced, and they don't got the income to service it. So they got to borrow even more if someone will loan it to them, or be bailed out by the government. Or if not, then they go bankrupt. They default. And we're seeing some cracks in the default edifice here globally beginning to emerge in Europe, in emerging markets, and with companies that are really overextended, like General Electric. Okay, so we have a massive increase in debt over and above what we had in 2007, and it's corporate debt, and it's non-financial corporate debt. A lot of it's in emerging markets, but a lot of it's in the U.S. because the Fed had such low interest rates, it allowed everybody to get so over-indebted. Fundamentally, it's the Fed that starts this whole process and has been for decades. And then, of course, fundamentally tripling of corporate profits since 2010, which, by the way, is largely due to what's cost containment. In other words, wages. It's not because corporations have sold so much more that they've got such profits. It's profit margins, which means reducing costs. And that's the big driver for this corporate profit boom since 2010. But also, fundamentally, we have what we call a financial asset shift that I talk about in my Systemic Fragility book in 2016. What is that? And that is this network of finance capital elites now, with their liquid markets and their shadow banks and their growing dominance, not just in the economy, but in government itself. You know, I mean, Goldman Sachs is a shadow bank, and it's running U.S. economic policy, both at the Fed, at the Treasury, and within the White House. Well, I've talked about that before and have articles published on that. Well, there's a shift, a relative shift to financial asset investing because it's more profitable, it's safer, they can take their money and run quicker because it's more liquid, right? And the amount of liquidity, money capital, is so massive, it's far more than's even necessary were they to properly fund real asset investment, infrastructure, and so forth. It's just we've flooded the world with money, and that's the fundamental causes. The Fed and the excess liquidity driven by these low rates and Fed monetary policy, tripling corporate profits, and this shift that I'm talking about. Okay, so what next, right? What next? Where are the soft spots here, or the dangerous spots? Where could this thing going? Well, we have this phenomenon of exchange-traded funds and products and notes and automated selling by the quants. Momentum trading up goes momentum trading down. A good example of this was the derivatives that have been created on this index called the VIX. The VIX is supposed to show the volatility of the stock market. Well, the VIX has become a kind of derivative itself. Speculators have been selling products, allowing people to buy derivatives, futures, and options, betting that the VIX would remain stable. And of course, a lot of people, a lot of investors plunged into that because it looked like for a whole year the VIX and the market was, you know, strangely stable and for quite some time. So this speculation on ETFs was added by ETF or derivatives in the form of VIX bets, VIX. And when the price, when the market got unstable and the VIX went to 20, 30 points instead of 10, well, huge losses, and people had to dump their derivatives here, their futures and so forth, based on the VIX. So the VIX became not an indicator of risk in the financial markets, but a cause of the risk and volatility in the markets. It's totally worthless now. As we get, here's another one where things could go. If we have a continued raise in the Fed rates, the dollar is going to start rising, which it has. That's going to cause a currency volatility globally, and you're going to have a collapse of currencies in emerging markets, and therefore capital flight from those markets to the dollar. And as that happens, these emerging markets, Latin America and elsewhere, their financial markets will decline, and they're going to have to raise their interest rates to keep the capital flight down, and that will provoke a domestic a real recession in these economies. So emerging markets, watch them. You know, a lot of debt, $25 trillion, has been plunged into these emerging markets. China, the China stock market is really declining faster than the U.S. Dow. And their currency is depreciating the fastest it has in several years. There's the stock sell-off. As the China investors sell off their stock, they want to convert their currency, the yuan, to dollars, because yuan is falling and dollars are rising, which means they want to take it out of the country. The biggest decline since the China stock crash in 2015. It's trading now, the yuan, at 6.3 instead of 6.89 to the dollar. The U.S. index stock currency index is rising over 1% per month as Fed rates rise. Another reason why the Fed won't be able to continue raising rates is going to cause such instability in global currencies that it's going to back off. Right. So watch China stock market and China currency depreciation. What's going to happen there? Watch the VIX. Watch ETFs and ETNs. What's going to happen there, and derivative trading, and watch the junk bond market. Watch junk bonds, right? Non-financial debt now is 96% of GDP. That's almost $19 trillion. 37% of all U.S. corporations are highly leveraged, in other words, junk, right? And that compared with 32% in 2007. So there's more junk bond fragile securities out there today than there were before, ever before. And also watch the, in Europe, the over $1 trillion or more of non-performing bank loans, particularly in Italy. So all these things could drive the market down another leg or so. So let's watch those, and we'll continue doing that. All right, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Vision.